Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. Government surveillance of the kind that we now know takes place on a daily basis is not at all a new phenomenon in the United States. The post-9/11 world of collect it all is different from previous eras, mostly in the available technology and the reach of spy agencies to watch our every move. 40 years ago, the Church Committee, named after Idaho Senator Frank Church, set out to investigate the extent of the government's spying activities at that time. Out of the work by the 11-member group came the establishment of congressional intelligence committees and the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, under which secret courts were established to oversee spying programs. But today, neither has been a very reliable check on government. Joining me in studio today is Frederick A.O. Schwartz. He was the chief counsel for the Church Committee 40 years ago. He has a new book out called Democracy in the Dark, The Seduction of Government Secrecy, and he thinks we need a new Church Committee. Welcome to Uprising, Fritz.
I'm glad to be here.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, you write that too much is kept secret to not to protect America, but to keep embarrassing or illegal conduct from Americans, and that is part of the fear that we have of government secrecy today, that government officials claim everything must be kept secret in the interest of national security. But it turns out when people start peeling back the layers, when there are whistleblowers, that some of that information or a big part of it is just kept there because they want to have it for some reason in the future, or because it, sometimes it's just too embarrassing.
Yeah, they stop thinking. That's one of the most dangers of the seduction of secrecy, that once something's stamped secret, people just stop thinking. For example, the 9/11 warnings that the White House got were stamped top secret legitimately, but when they had so many as they did, they should have revealed it to the public, and we might have well have prevented 9/11, but people just stop thinking when something is stamped as secret.
So how does today's current surveillance state and system compared to what we had in the country in the 70s or leading up to the 70s and through the 70s?
Well, as you say, the technology is different. The technology is far more powerful. Senator Church went on television during the middle of our hearings and said, we are at risk of being totally overcome by the surveillance. But that surveillance then was in the Stone Age as compared today. It's much broader, much more dangerous. Although the technology also is one of the seeds for why I'm optimistic that over the next years, we're going to get change, because people in the most intelligent people in the intelligence agencies are saying we've got too much, and having too much gets in the way of the speed of distributing things, so we should cut down on secrecy.
So tell us a little bit about the Church Committee itself. People sort of forget about this today. What was the political context of the time, and how much of it was a result of journalism, was exposing that we were being surveilled?
Journalism is extremely important, was then, still is. The context of the time was we'd had the Vietnam War. Americans were upset about what they thought the government was doing.
Passed to the official end of the anniversary of the end of the Vietnam
War. Right, and that was happening at the same time. Yeah. Watergate had happened. That made people worry about government overreaching. And so the Church Committee was established. Now, many people thought what we would do is just find more bad stuff that Richard Nixon had done. And I think our most powerful finding was that every president from Franklin Roosevelt through Richard Nixon, 4 Democrats and 2 Republicans, had overplayed their power. Now, some of the things that we found out, just to tick off 3 quickly, one was that the FBI tried to destroy Martin Luther King by actually trying to get him to commit suicide. The CIA hired the mafia to help them try to kill Fidel Castro. And the National Security Agency, or NSA as we know it mostly, tried to get copies of every telegram that left the United States. But today, the problems are worse because of the increasing strength of the technology.
So they it was only an 11-member committee. How did they and how did you, working with them, get access to the information? I mean, you must have had to have the CIA comply with you, which couldn't have been an easy task.
Or the FBI.
Or the FBI, yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, who knows whether they ever gave us everything they should have, but we got an enormous amount. We got more information about the secret government than ever has happened in the United States or ever has happened in the world. Two factors helped us, two human factors. One, J. Edgar Hoover was dead. He was so scary to people that had he still been alive, could we have gotten all the information about the FBI that we did? That's an open question. Second thing is that Gerald Ford had become president. He was the first person to become president who hadn't even been elected to be vice president. And he was very vulnerable to an accusation that he was not cooperating with us, because Nixon, after all, had fallen because he tried to abuse his secret powers and use the CIA to stop the FBI. So Ford was a little bit weak and had to be willing to cooperate with us. And so those reasons, plus a lot of pressure from us, were why we got as much information as we did.
And speaking of J. Edgar Hoover, in your book you claim that he and Dick Cheney reshaped American government and American life. And you single these two men out. Hoover might be dead, but Cheney's still around. Why do these two men stand out so much?
Well, because they had such power, and they both, at the height of their power, abused secrecy. Cheney's an interesting story, though, in the book. What I point out is that he, in his earlier days, first had said presidential meetings. He was chief of staff for President Gerald Ford, and he had said presidential meetings, the ones held in the White House, not public, but the president must hear all sides. And of course, when he becomes vice president, his technique with George W. Bush was basically, George W. Bush should hear only me, not all sides. The other, even more interesting one, is something I discovered in writing this book that had never been exposed before, that when Cheney was in Congress, he was a congressman from Wyoming, and he was the leading Republican on the so-called Iran-Contra investigation that investigated what Ronald Reagan had done in Iran to sell them weapons and to give money to the Contras in Nicaragua. But Cheney, in his long dissent from the majority opinion, wrote that a wise government, a wise White House, will not rely on excessive secrecy and will engage in something that he called democratic persuasion, which he defined as not doing something hard and important in foreign policy or national security area without having a full airing to the public.
Right.
And yet again, of course, when he was vice president, that was the farthest from the policy of the Bush administration.
Why is secrecy so seductive, to paraphrase your subtitle? I mean, we supposedly live in democracies. The whole idea is that we need to have checks and balances on these sorts of abuses of power. And if we don't, what sets us apart from a dictatorship?
Well, the key to democracy is the public getting information. And the key to that is journalism and the government itself behaving properly. But on the seduction of secrecy, it seduces both the writer and the listener. The writer, I'll give an example on each side. In the writer's case, right now, each year, 100 million new documents are stamped secret. That's a staggering amount. So if you want to have anybody read your memo, you better try to classify it as top secret, and even there are classifications even beyond top secret, because otherwise nobody's going to read it.
Right.
So in that sense, secrecy spawns more secrecy. Then in terms of the seduction to the listener is, first place, a lot of readers assume secrecy is the same thing as true. Secret is the same thing as true. And they decline to pay attention to things that aren't secreted. For example, the CIA, which has been told to have a whole institute on what's called, which is on non-secret intelligence, is slow to do it. And way back in World War II, when we had made heroic efforts and great successes in breaking the Nazis' code, unfortunately, sometimes people who had access to that information didn't bother to look at other information. And so while it was wonderful, the seduction of the highly secret made you fail to look at things that aren't secret.
Hmm. And so a big part of what came out from 9/11 was government agencies needing to share information. But some people thought that even civil libertarians were worried about the sharing of information.
Well, but the you can walk and chew gum, I think, and they were correct. The 9/11 Commission was correct that the CIA didn't tell the FBI some information that could have led to arresting a couple of the hijackers, mm-hmm. and then that might have unrolled the whole plot. So they were right that the government agencies themselves should share. There are limits on everything. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't want to share, like J. Edgar Hoover did, all the dirt on people. And my point that I think an even more fundamental failure leading to 9/11 was that the White House didn't even think about releasing the very, very scary warnings it got, and it got a lot of them from the CIA, and just let those out to the public. And I lay out in the book why I think that very likely would have prevented 9/11. But it wasn't because they were bad people in this respect. It was because they just didn't think.
My guest is Fritz Schwartz, whose book, Democracy in the Dark, The Seduction of Government Secrecy, lays out the case for, among other things, why we might need a new church committee. Let's talk about that. What could a similar committee to the one that you participated in 40 years ago, what would you like to see it be comprised of, and what would it do?
Well, the first thing is it has to approach its job from a nonpartisan point of view. And
which these days is a tall order.
but we did that in the church committee. We had 6 Democrats and 5 Republicans. The vice chair was a Republican. It's a different system. Mm-hmm. And it would normally have been 7 Democrats and 4, but the powers that be made it 6 and 5. And as I say, I think our most important finding was that presidents of both parties had abused their power. So the first thing a new committee should do is be nonpartisan. That's easier to do now than it was. I started calling for a new church committee back in 07 or 08. And then one drawback would have been it only could have focused post 9/11 on the one administration, the George W. Bush administration. Today, a new church committee could focus on both a Republican and a Democratic, the Obama administration, and that, I think, helps it be nonpartisan. Then, assuming it's nonpartisan, it has to be rigorous. You have to get the information. But you also have to recognize that there are some legitimate secrets. There was at the same time as the church committee, which was in the Senate, there was a House committee, and it could have done enormously good work because it was focusing less on misbehavior, which in a way was what the church committee mainly did, and more on the quality of the work that was coming out of the intelligence community. But it was generally a failure because it did not recognize the legitimacy of some secrecy. So you have to start with the view that, yes, there's too much, and yes, it lasts for too long, but you must recognize some secrecy is legitimate.
Can you give us an historical example of what might be, should have been a legitimate secret?
Well, I'll give you an example and then give an exception to it.
Okay.
A legitimate secret would be a weakness in your own military. And we can go way back to George Washington on that. George Washington concealed from the British and actually put out false information about the amount of ammunition, gunpowder, and weapons that he had as he sat in the hills outside Boston and the British sat in the city of Boston. And if the truth had been known, the British might well have been able to push Washington away and defeat his army very early in the war. Perfect example of legitimately keeping secret a military weakness. Now let's go up to the Iraq War. And you remember the situation where the IEDs, improvised explosive devices, were blowing up under American vehicles and blowing up the vehicle, the bottom of the vehicle, and blowing up the bottoms of the men and women that were sitting in the vehicle. Terrible results for those poor people who were hit by these devices. Now, it turned out, and this comes out in Robert Gates's recent autobiography, that a leak about the problem and how slow the military was in solving it, I think it was a leak to USA Today, and Robert Gates, Secretary of Defense, read about that leak, and he said, get going, fix this problem, fix it faster. So it was an example of where actually a leak about what was a military weakness, but nonetheless was helpful. So it's, I could give similar examples for every instance of legitimate secrecy and say, here's why it's generally legitimate, and here's an exception that limits your belief that it's legitimate.
On the church committee and the idea to have a new church committee, I mean, one would imagine that a long-term fix to abuse of state powers on surveillance and other things is what's most desired. And perhaps a church committee 40 years ago thought they were doing that with the establishment of the intelligence committees in the in houses of Congress, and also the creation of the FISA courts. But today, we have intelligence committees either not being given enough information, being spied on themselves, as we saw the Senate Intelligence Committee last year on the torture report about the CIA, and the FISA courts literally being part of the problem and putting a stamp of approval on surveillance.
Yeah.
I'm sure 40 years ago you didn't expect that.
We did not, and actually I know that Fritz Mondale, who was very involved, Senator Mondale and then Vice President Mondale, very involved in the FISA court, is writing something about how it has changed and how that, and I write something in the book about that also in Democracy in the Dark. Well, if you can get 35 years of improvement, that's good. It's not good enough. You have to be internally vigilant.
Yeah.
What did Jefferson say? Eternal vigilance is the something of liberty, you know?
And so then what, you know, I mean, perhaps they're only going through a process can make apparent what solutions we can come up with. But a new church committee, what could a new church committee do? You know, President Obama has appointed his own task force for what to do about or to, you know, investigate the NSA. But this is like asking the, you know, it's like asking the police to police themselves.
Well, not really, because the Senate can be critical of the Senate, and that's, although that's not done, but too much. But we were critical of how the Congress had done beforehand.
Right.
And FISA, one of the problems with FISA is it's now doing things that no court should do. The legitimate reason for the FISA court was to look at individual demands for information, warrantless wiretapping of a suspect. In the same way as in regular criminal cases, a magistrate in secret grants a warrant. Where FISA went wrong was when the government persuaded it to act not as a court deciding a narrow matter, but as in effect a legislature, and it isn't a legislature, it's a court. Now, the new church committee will come. It doesn't have to come tomorrow, but it will come. And when it comes, we will learn facts that are worse than we thought we knew. We will learn more things. There are things we don't yet know. And that's what drives, one of the things that drives reform is people getting bothered by what they learn.
Didn't the 9/11 Commission do some of what one might have expected a sort of church committee to do?
I think it was narrower. I did, in general, I think it did an extremely good job. And they certainly, they were very nonpartisan, too. Mm-hmm. That was another one of their best, and the way they sat, you know, they didn't sit Democrats in the left and Republicans on the right. They sat mixed up. The only thing I criticize them for is that they didn't say, well, the White House should have exposed what should have revealed, not exposed, the warnings that it had gotten. Right. But they weren't designed to be a general review of the intelligence community. They were designed to look at one terrible specific event.
And also, of course, what came out of the church committee that I'm guessing what you really want to happen is a perhaps greater transformation of our government system to put at greater checks and balances. I want to turn to the Obama administration. And as you said, any new committee that's formed can impartially look at the last two administrations, one mm-hmm. Democratic and one Republican, to see, you know, perhaps equal amounts of abuses of power. The Obama administration is interesting in that it boasts that it's the most transparent administration in U.S. history. We, of course, know that it's one of the most secretive, but we shouldn't be surprised by that claim, right?
Well, I think the as a generality, it's very common for people before they're elected to bow toward openness, and then after they are elected to bend toward secrecy. That's quite common. Obama is an interesting mixed story. I mean, he has done things that were more open. When he started, he revealed the torture memos that had been kept secret, and that was an important step. But on a more structural basis, he has improved the transparency. He's improved the extent to which the intelligence agency's budgets are made known. It still has to be better, but he's improved it. He issued a lot of information on our nuclear capacity that was previously secret. Where he's been, I think, least good, most secretive, is in supporting the Justice Department's efforts to close down cases, for example, on torture, where some person found already to be innocent, not Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, mm-hmm. but someone who was tortured and has been found to be innocent and then brought a lawsuit against the United States for torture, and the Justice Department has uniformly succeeded in using something called the state secrets doctrine to get those cases dismissed. And another area in which the Obama administration has gone beyond its predecessors in secrecy is in threatening journalists and in some cases prosecuting whistleblowers.
Yes, absolutely, and actively going after journalists like James Risen, a story we've been covering quite a lot on our program. And on the issue of journalism, 40 years ago was the work of people like Seymour Hersh that revealed mm-hmm. the CIA's dirty deeds. Today we have folks like Glenn Greenwald, James Risen, and others.
Snowden also.
And of course Edward Snowden, absolutely. You earlier in our conversation talked about how technology has not just increased the reach of surveillance, but it could also actually be a tool to curb surveillance. Is that because of the ease of being able to leak information these days?
Well, in that is one reason that when someone leaks now, I mean, it took Daniel Ellsberg to for Pentagon Papers, which were, I think, a total of 7,000 pages, about 4 months to photocopy them.
Yeah.
Now someone like Manning or Snowden can snap the finger and they have a million times as much volume. Now I lost your question, though.
And so can technology actually help us curb?
Well, technology can, because as you say, leaks can be bigger. And I think most importantly, because the smart people in the agencies, and I developed this in the conclusion of my book, particularly mm-hmm. talking about a book by a man called Joel Brenner, who'd been a high-ranking intelligence official, and who takes the position that the coin of the realm today in protecting the nation is speed of getting information to the right person. And when you have this enormous, these enormous mountains of documents that are secret, he says, well, that inevitably makes it harder to act quickly. And we should get over, the country should get over the idea that it's going to protect all this information, which, as you say, either through leaks or because there are other ways in which it's discovered, is going to come out anyway. We should get over that, and we should no longer rely on secrecy to protect ourselves to the same extent.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today and shedding some light on this information. And maybe in the next few years, we'll see if we do get a new church committee. Thank you so much.
Well, we're going to get it sometime, yeah. And we're going to get reform sometime. And I hope my book, Democracy in the Dark, moves the debate along.
My guest is Frederick A. O. Schwartz. He was a chief counsel for the Church Committee 40 years ago. He has a new book out that we've been discussing called Democracy in the Dark, The Seduction of Government Secrecy. This is Uprising.